and that just as surely as the reasonable represents Cronus, so beyond the reasonable is the mysterious power of the good, which is Uranus, or Eurytus, the mysterious god who was sacrificed and immolated in order that Cronus might come to his throne. Therefore, beyond reason is heaven, which was the symbol that Uranus represented. The great vistered bowl of the sky, star-spangled with 100 million worlds. This was beyond reason. It was beyond the reasonable man to comprehend. Yet that which is beyond reason, that which is beyond thought, that which is beyond daily and constant experience of man, can this in any way be known? Can that which is beyond knowledge be known? Can that which transcends any faculty or power of our common experience be in itself known? Plotinus thought that it could be known, in a way. It could be known to man by means of an impact. Man looking up to the sky does not know the sky, but he wonders upon it and about it. And if he is a poet, he may feel a tremendous emotional surge from the majesty and mystery of this vast empyrean around him. To him, the sky carries certain overtones, vastness, universality, profundity, mystery, majesty, sublimity. All these things moving in upon the individual result in the development or integration of a superior group of faculties. These faculties have to do with what the old physiognomists and phrenologists referred to as the faculties of sublimity. And sublimity is the impact of universals. Sublimity is this mysterious power which is ignored by the foolish, who can walk under the bowl of heaven from the cradle to the grave and find nothing in the sky above them except space and a few wandering stars. Sublimity, however, is something that reaches those in whose hearts and minds there is not only intellectual power, but a certain strange romancing instinct. Sublimity is for poets, for mystics. But poets, as we realize, are the prophets of races, that upon their early labors, more sober men later carved the mausoleums of people. For it is the poet who gives birth, it is the philosopher who buries the races of the earth. This concept has to Plotinus a great importance, namely that man can receive into his own nature something that is immeasurable, yet in its immeasurableness has that quality in it which, cutting through intellect and emotion, brings a common amazement to the child and the sage, an amazement which is the natural gift of the small child and the cultivated gift of the aged man. Something that we outgrow in a funny way by becoming less than we were before. The child looks out upon the universe as the great adventure, mature man as the great disillusionment. And yet beyond this there must be something else. The child is righter than the man, because the man has built a grave for himself in a universe in which there is no death. These kind of thoughts move Plotinus to the state, or to the concept, that there is, above reason, man's power to apperceive the simple substance of the good. Now, the good is a term which to us means very little. Almost anything we like is good. Almost anything we do not like is not good. We throw it in conflict to bad, meaning pleasant and unpleasant for the most part. But to Plotinus, there was a sovereignty of good of itself. And good is in some way one of the most profound experiences of which man is capable. Good is beyond reason. Good is something which reason may aspire to. Good is something without which practically every noble sentiment of man would perish. For all who labor sincerely, honorably, earnestly, labor toward the good, for the good, or in the spirit of goodness. Yet none can define this very substance of their own endeavor. The good, therefore, to Plotinus, was a kind of enduring archetypal principle that transcended even heaven, that transcended everything that we know, but of which heaven itself, with its infinite majesty, in the profundities of which all inadequacy seemed to be lost and buried, that vastness which man can explore from its various dimensions and find nothing bad, this something which is unutterable, to Plotinus, awakened, stimulated, or inspired, released or revealed in man himself a mood, a kind of nature, a reaching outness, a capacity for the experience of sublimity. And Plotinus declared that this capacity was the ever-flowing fountain of the good. So behind rationality, we discover that the only purpose for reason is to discover the good. The only purpose for virtue is to live according to the good. The only purpose of beauty is that it shall reveal the dimensions of the good. The only purpose of happiness is that it shall cause us to experience a sensation of the good within our own nature. Therefore, instead of seeking to be happy primarily, man experiences happiness ultimately only to the degree that it is founded in good, that it produces consequences from itself which can never be contrary to the pleasure which we cultivate. Plotinus then said, how shall we experience or know this nature of the good? How shall we experience pure good as apart from its conditioned aspects, its negative expressions in our daily living? He realized that there is only one possible way that man can ever grasp or control or come to attunement with universals, and that is through a series of living instruments. He would have had no faith in the telescope and no faith in the microscope to accomplish more than to reveal to man other phases of a nature which extends in many directions, but which is always on a kind of level. Plotinus believed that only living instruments would be capable of achieving unity or experience within living forces. That these things cannot be communicated, they cannot be passed on as a priceless heritage, they do not need to be perpetuated by men because they are self-perpetuating. If there was not a good man for a million years, goodness would not die. For the first good man who was born after that time would embody it again. That this goodness has a total existence in itself, but that its expression upon any level of function depends upon instruments upon that level. He therefore held that goodness is a sovereign principle in itself, and that those who approach it become like it. Those who become like it become endowed with its attributes and become capable of expressing these attributes in their own lives. Thus, growth is an approaching. It is man coming nearer and nearer to a substance. And to achieve this nearness, he is constantly required to become like this substance, for he cannot approach anything from which he is divided by difference. Therefore, he approaches by similarity and remains aloof by difference. Thus, only the good can know the good. Thus, only the good can experience the good. And regardless of what we think or believe, each individual is continuously experiencing the good as he is, sharing in that part of the good which he has attained by his own moral and ethical existence. But beyond his experience, he can approach the good only by the gradual extension through discipline of his own nature toward goodness, and toward the gradual elimination of interval by eliminating qualitative difference. This is the same concept that lies behind the principle of yoga. For in the highest phase of Hatha Yoga, Raja Yoga, we are confronted with the great problem of similitude. We mentioned in the last lecture the discussion of sympathies between gods and men, as held by the Greeks. The Neoplatonists held this sympathy to be true, a kind of fact, namely, that nothing similar can be divided, and nothing dissimilar can be united. Therefore, all things seeking reality must become themselves real. All things desiring union with peace must of themselves become peace. Those things desiring to become united with wisdom must achieve this union by becoming themselves wisdom. Buddha points out, of course, the importance of not saying, in this instance, that they shall become wise. Buddha said we should not say that to approach wisdom we must become wise. He would say with the Neoplatonists that to approach wisdom, we must become wisdom. Because to become wise assumes that we are to attain a state within ourselves that has a separateness from the goal that we seek. The wise man, in a strange way, defeats the concept of wisdom, because he represents an achievement separate from a total existence. Whereas in reality, what we call a wise man, if we may refer to such, is merely a man in whom wisdom is apparent. It is not that he is wise, but that he has become susceptible of existing in a state of wisdom. For wisdom is not of himself. Wisdom is of the good. It is therefore man's possibility to express wisdom, but it is never of his possibility to possess it. He moves into adjustments with something having an eternal subsistence in eternity. And this subsistence is the wisdom principle itself, or the principle of good in itself. Beyond wisdom, beyond goodness, beyond sublimity, Plotinus apexed his tremendous concept of mystical theology by his creation of the sign or symbol of ultimate, and that is what he called the alone. The alone is that by which nothing else is comparable. The alone is that in which there can be no nature but itself. That which is alone means that which is strangely and wonderfully and totally unique. And in you being totally unique, it depends upon its unique totality, the alone, which is the end of all, is that which rests forever, alone because it can never be known by anything except itself. It is the uniquely misunderstood. It is that reality of which we all feel we have a sovereign participation, because there is scarcely a person who does not inwardly feel to be alone because of a uniqueness in himself by which he declares that all others understand him only in part. Thus, this negative phase of uniqueness, loneliness, is the absolute opposite of the alone. That which is separated from the alone is lonely. That which achieves union with the alone is alone. And the difference between the lonely and the alone is something that even on our little narrow theater of activity, we can perhaps give some concept to. Because there are people who by circumstances or necessity live solitary lives. Some of these people are lonely. Others are alone. And even in our own experience, there is a vital difference between these two things. The lonely individual is one who longs for an association or a reunion with things. But that person who is alone may have the strange, deep strength of his own aloneness. The lonely person is weak. The person alone may be very, very strong. There is a difference here, a difference of psychological interpretation of one mystical fact. If aloneness represents the individual deprived of association, then he is lonely. But if aloneness means that the individual has found union with a uniqueness within himself, by means of which he has been reunited with this principle of solitary sublimity, then he is not lonely, but he is again alone. For of all things, as Plotinus tells us, that which is most alone is God. For God, strangely as it may seem, though in everything and of everything, governing all things out of the majesty of its own power, present in various attributes and aspects in everything that exists, yet God is completely alone. And the reason why this is true is that it's or the divine flame or spark in the life of every creature is unknowable to every other creature and unknown by that creature itself. Therefore, it remains completely isolated, completely alone. The last thing that any man will ever know is the God in himself. Therefore, the deity, though ever present, remains the most distant, remains the most completely separate from all things. Plotinus, following Diogenes of Sinopus, also explains to us that this alone, this state of alone, is possible only to that which is primary. Nothing which is dependent upon anything can be alone, but can be lonely. To be alone and to survive means that that being or creature must be the source of everything necessary to itself and the fulfillment of every need which it may experience. It must be its own source of life. It must be its own source of generation, propagation, and creation. And that which creates, propagates, or generates must be itself. So in the one alone, we have also the absolutely supernal attribute of the divine, namely that it depends upon nothing. Yet this power, dependent upon nothing, gains from the mystic a strange sympathy. This power, which man does not recognize as alone, but is rather inclined to regard as lonely as the human heart, man seeking to comfort God, seeking to take away from himself and his deity this sense of isolation, affirms and assumes that he is necessary to this God and that this God is necessary to him and that therefore neither can be alone. The mystic, however, is moving only within the sphere of his own experience. Actually, his need is eternal, but the need of the one which is alone he cannot know, nor can he even attempt to speculate about it. So in the Neoplatonic and in the Greek mysteries, the universe is divided into two things, that which is alone and that which is lonely. And the great journey of life, as Proclus tells us, is the journey of the lonely to that which is alone. It is the journey, therefore, away from separateness, by which a loneliness is implied, lostness, as in the story of the prodigal son, or in the wandering sheep, the return of that which is lonely, is without consolation, is disconsolate in its own soul, the return of that to the splendid mystery of that which is alone and never weak. These contemplations all point to the upper structure of Neoplatonic theology. They point out that all rational contemplation, all inspirational, intuitional, illuminal contemplation of the principle of the rational and the principle of the good, that all of this leads to a final higher mysticism and impels us to include Neoplatonism among the great systems of revelational knowledge. For in Neoplatonism it becomes increasingly obvious that the higher steps of the discipline depend upon a curious rapport between the alone and the lonely heart, that man in some mysterious way finds in his loneliness some clue to the aloneness of the eternal. And he discovers also that out of his own loneliness comes the strange mystery of his own strength, that it is in his loneliness that he transcends himself, that it is in this loneliness that the false consolations of an illusional existence fall away, that in loneliness man must face himself, must experience the needs of his own inner life, and his loneliness tells him of the emptiness of his own core. It tells him that he is without center. Therefore, that his longings, his yearnings, his strange negative sighings after something, all these pressures reveal to him his own central weakness, that he cannot endure himself, that he cannot survive himself, that he is completely lost. He has not achieved that wonderful state of the French essayist who on one occasion coined that beautiful statement, never less alone than when alone. This difference is the motion toward the inner life. This is the motion which causes man gradually to orient in a sphere of transcendental values. It causes him to realize, first of all, that he can go through all of the so-called achievements of man and still remain lonely. And this loneliness is the hunger after eternity, as Behme calls it, the hunger for the eternal in man. It is the thing which probably symbolically gave rise to such stories of the prodigal son returning to his father's house, or the Gnostic hymn of the robe of glory. Here we have the wanderer struggling through a strange and desolate region, sustained only by the half-remembered vision of a better distant place. Here we have Parsifal, the knight of the Grail, who had been cast out of the castle because he was a young and guileless fool, who was not apparently able to understand, but ever having seen the strange sacrament of the Grail, he devoted his life to the long, distant, difficult wanderings to find again the castle which first he had not appreciated or understood. And at last, in black armor and visored and helmed, he is seen on Good Friday returning up the narrow pathway that leads back to the castle of the Grail. And it's here that Gurnemunds, the great retainer knight, sings the wonderful story that tells of this youth coming back, searching for a lifetime to find the mysterious temple on the mountains, which he had seen as a boy, which had then been meaningless, but which he had never been able to forget. And in man, this never forgetting, this ever to remember, this peculiar psychological experience of an endless loneliness that can only terminate in God. Plotinus said this instinct is there. It is an instinct so strong that this is the great instinct. This is the great pressure which moves all human beings. Whether recognized, unrecognized, served or not served, every human being is lonely until it is returned to the alone. Disciplines, therefore, begin to take on a rather quiet, almost note of pathos. They are this gentle seeking after a very gentle mystery. For this mystery is never going to be spectacular. It is never man conquering space or riding out on some strange cosmic conveyance into the distant places of immeasurable time and eternity. It is the pilgrim going home. Home out beyond the stars or within the stars and everywhere. And that this true one alone that waits is everywhere, in everything, covered and crossed by this distance of man moving from loneliness toward that which is alone, which he discovers its nature by his own privation, so that he comes to discover deity as something which has about it a quality of ageless yearning, something that was undoubtedly far beyond the concepts of that time, but it was a very deep and noble concept toward which Plotinus tried to inspire his students and disciples. Thus the universe became the sphere of these great desires. Gods and planets and angels were only the embodiments of these moods, these tremendous pressures of things. And growth was the systematic ascent of the orbit of the seven stars. It was man moving through the universe, and in this motion, discovering the gods, uniting with them, carrying them on also, but discovering everywhere only one thing, a universe lonely for its maker. And of course, by natural assumption, assuming in some way that this maker was like the father of the prodigal son, who in his quietude and in his waiting waited for his son to come back. It might have been a little sentimental in that department, but still it conveyed a sense of values. It moved life entirely away from brilliance of achievement to homely things, to the homely love of father and child, and the homely desire of the wandering and lost child to find the security of the father's house. So Plotinus invited the students that he had to consider this journey as the principal course of their lives, that they should return again to the golden age from which they had come, to the shadowy mystery from which they had been born, and to strive valiantly to find the alone which is at the root of all things. Now, this brings us to another important separating thought, and that is Plotinus applying his concepts to such attributes as space and time, came to a very interesting combination of definitions. To him, space is man's symbol of the alone. And by the same analogy, time is man's symbol of loneliness. Time and space, therefore, are loneliness and the alone. Time is the measure of the great journey of the home seeker. Time is something that is forever separating man, at the same time impelling him or moving him according to the vast pageantries of space. Space, therefore, being the alone, is the only self-sufficient form of existence. Space is in itself and of itself unique and complete. Space is infinite potential. It is all fullness. It is inscrutability. It is that in which there can be no hunger and no thirst. It is that from which nothing can be derived other than within its own nature. So space is an alone that is never lonely. Because being all, it is never separate. It never exists in relation to anything else, because its totality is unique within itself. Time, however, is a measure of events, the measure of a struggle in which from the cradle to the grave and by the great cycles of rebirth in nature, man is forever measuring his separateness and striving to overcome it. So striving and time, peace and space, have become synonymous. Now Plotinus said, therefore, in his great interpretation of the theology, that man, trying to become like space, or like eternity, as differentiated from his time obsessions, must discover that there is only one way of being alone without being lonely, and that is to be complete. Completeness can leave no loneliness, because in completeness there is no yearning of divided parts. In completeness there can be no deficiency or separateness by which the experience of loneliness is possible. The number one, for example, stands for the first. It also stands for the all. It stands for the totality. One is the unique number. Therefore, one is the one alone. But the one is not lonely, because from it moves the progeny of number. From it unfolds the whole mystery of diversity. Yet this number itself is unique and alone to the end. By this aloneness, it is supreme. It is the number of numbers, the golden number. That which is the symbol of absolute truth, absolute good, absolute reality. Yet when we think of this one standing alone, we must never think of it other than as all. For in this allness of it, it absorbs loneliness. Because loneliness is privation. It is the deficiency of something within the nature of beings. And there can be no deficiency in the presence of totality. How then, says Plotinus, shall we make this an operating fact in our own daily life? First of all, we must contemplate for our own daily use on a very simple level to begin with. Always remembering, however, that these levels extend archetypally and that to achieve on one level is to symbolically state achievement on all levels. And that the individual who masters a principle upon one level has gained an insight which will enable him to adjust to other levels. Therefore, any actual accomplishment of a true attainment becomes a universal key to attainment. For all attainments are of one essential nature, though they may differ in degrees and magnitudes. In our daily conscious functioning, therefore, the difference between aloofness or isolation and integration may be the way in which we approach the difference between loneliness and aloneness. Aloneness, first of all, rises from the recognition that man's supreme strength lies internal, that the alone in him is alone capable of victory, that the alone in him gives him the sovereign right to be himself at all times, under all conditions, in all pressures, and in all circumstances. Each man is unique. Therefore, it is utterly unnecessary for him to take on the superstitions, the doubts, the fears, or the emergencies of others. He may be sympathetic to them. He may strive to assist them. But in any way in which they fall short, it is not necessary that he copies them, that he be like them, or that he depend upon them for the fulfillment of values that can arise only within his own nature. Man's aloneness in its internal uniqueness makes man superior to time and place, makes him superior to the dogma of 100 cults, makes him superior to all laws known to man, and at the same time makes him superior to any action contrary to that which is right or reasonable. Therefore, the man who is superior to law is not the lawbreaker. The individual who never breaks the law is superior to the law. The individual who never becomes involved in that which is less needs, therefore, not to pass through certain circumstances through which we commonly pass in our daily living. Now, we do not expect, and Plotinus did not expect, that anyone would live by so grandiose an abstraction in a single magnificent gesture. He recommended a series of gentle, slow processes of exploration and experimentation within the self, realizing that our weakness is in the sense of our isolation, and our strength is the sense of belonging, that the individual feels greater courage when he is with others, or is with the power of a superior force. Then the individual should realize that his supreme strength is when he is with the core of his own purposes. That in every case, his orientation means that he shall be in the center of himself. that his orientation means that he shall in himself find that refuge which he is forever seeking elsewhere. Plotinus recommends that men recover from the illusion that anything, anywhere, anytime can make them happy. And also from the equally serious delusion that anything, anywhere, anytime can make them unhappy. Unhappiness or happiness depends upon man's internal understanding of the difference between loneliness and aloneness. The lonely must always be unhappy. The alone is never unhappy. That which is lonely is yearning for the communion with value. The alone is that value. Therefore, each person consists of a group of members, attitudes, emotions, and the 7-8-fold cycle of his own soul. Having within his nature many lonely beings, depending upon the alone in him for their security. The mind, emotions, all of the instincts, appetites, and attitudes of the individual depend for their validity and for their integrity upon the basic strength of the core person. Your whole life, as the lives of those around you, is to a measure involved in the core strength of yourself. Plotinus did not believe, materialistically speaking, that a person's own ego is that core, or that this individual must depend totally upon his own isolated efforts. To Plotinus, this alone, this core, is God, the supreme power, but experienced and known only through the personal experience of the individual, moving and moved by his longings and his yearnings and his aloneness toward this union with value. So that wherever the emergency arises in our own thinking, that we seek this core point, and in seeking it, we achieve it in only one way. And that is, as Plotinus points out, by a disciplined means of letting go of error. The Platonic theology, later the Neoplatonic, therefore again states the point that we have made so many times, that it all bases from one simple concept that we have in the scriptures, namely, be still and know that I am God. Through stillness, through this mysterious power to retire, to by making this wonderful night journey of the soul, man attains the incredible and yet inevitable end, namely, that he can retire into the complete uniqueness of himself and rest there upon the wind of ages. That he becomes, by this very virtue, immovable in virtue. That he becomes in this way so filled with the grace of the alone, that he is incapable of a destructive or evil action. That he is also incapable again of experiencing disorientation. And today our great problem is disorientation. And most disorientation is one form or another of fear, and most fear in human life depends upon this peculiar sense of loneliness. Loneliness is the root of fear. It is the strange sense of being orphaned from space. Loneliness is insecurity. It is confusion. It is the individual like the small child wandering about in a sea of stars, all strangely distant and mysterious. Loneliness is man living in a world of matter and looking around him and finding nothing but forms and never their souls. Loneliness is a human heart in a mechanistic universe. Loneliness is man's natural love of good in an unmoral universe, a universe he has created out of his own attitude toward life. It is also man's disorientation and fear and aloneness in his faith. If he kneels on his knees and prays to a God of anger, a God in some mysterious way to whom he cannot go home as a little child with simple faith and hope. So the moment his God is a God of battles, he is alone. And he is lonely because his own heart is not a heart of battles. The moment this deity becomes vast, great, impressive, majestic, regal, then this little loneliness comes back, because man does not expect to find understanding in the court of emperors, whether it be the emperor of the universe or anything else. This Lao Tzu very beautifully points out in his strange mystic Chinese verses. Man seeking for this which is alone is therefore never seeking the splendid. He is never seeking that which is tremendous. He is seeking that which is infinitely sensitive. That which in some mysterious way he can approach face on. Something to which he does not grovel. Something that he goes back to in a strange sense of total equality. Something that he recognizes is too big to belittle him. Too truly parental. That it is possible that that which is alone should not understand his loneliness. Thus this process, as Plotinus points out, is the process of simplicity in the night. It is something that is forever available, something that reaches out as we reach out. It is something very simple, known perhaps to furred things in the forest or bird upon the wing. For as one of the Greeks said, the bird lives and dies alone. The animal lives and dies alone. Is it lonely? That we do not know, because it is possible that it is only our own minds and the peculiar complex of our human genius that makes it possible for us to be lonely. It is quite possible that to these things that have much less of security than we will ever know, the mother bird guarding her eggs in a world of enemies with no one to protect, no skill to build with, no knowledge as we know to protect with, only some strange instinct, an instinct to live or die with that nest, and that nest the universe. And the whole universe bound into the sovereignty of this simple task. Is that bird ever alone? That we do not know. But we have strange, mysterious suspicion that it is not. And perhaps more than we, lives always in the presence of that which is alone, sharing its strange strength, and free of the dependency which comes from ignorance. So our aloneness is something that we can experiment with to discover the strange strength of it, and that as we make use of this strength, we have a new dimensional experience of God. The God of the alone. The God that comes alone to the alone. That which is utterly independent of priest or presbyter, that which is only available as the immediate experience of consciousness. It is evident that this type of thinking left Neoplatonism a frail little group of persons in a world that did not even know the meaning of the things that he taught. But through the passing of centuries, the world has become a little more lonely and a little more tired, and perhaps therefore a little more capable of understanding the true mystery of life, which is this journey toward the peculiar and wonderful security of identity with that which is simple and alone, that which is our strength, that which is our endless source of life and courage. Now, this whole concept and everything that relates to it, and far more than we can possibly mention, arose from the Greek theology. It was the final flowering, the sad, gentle flowering that followed the mystery of the age of Pericles. The golden age had passed away and was a shadow. Men had fallen into aloneness and loneliness both. The gods had returned to high Olympus. The saints no longer walked the earth. The sages had departed. And humanity, lonely for happiness, lonely for truth, lonely for love, reached out across the mysterious void left by the departure of the gods and began to muse, to contemplate, and finally came to this understanding that religion had never changed at all, that the gods had not departed, that nothing had actually changed except that man had become afraid, had become tired, and in his fear and tiredness had dissolved the golden age. That in the place of it he lived in an age of iron, an age of fear, an age of loneliness, because he could no longer see the gods, could no longer know them immediately, because he saw more clearly the hatreds of his fellow men. Plotinus was convinced that the great theology never changed. That 10,000 years ago or 10,000 years into the future, the relation of man and divinity would be the same, unchanging forever. And that the great process of human growth would always be the same, this motion of the lonely heart to union with the aloneness that is strength. That in this motion, man discovered again all the glories of the heavens, all the wonders of the angels, all the mysteries that had been locked from the day of creation. For he discovered it simply through his own gentle adjustment with it. And his gentle growth, his quiet, kindly search as the child seeking to be understood, in this way, man learns to understand. Plotinus tells us this story, tries to help us to understand it, and leaves it to us as his heritage. And I think beyond any question of doubt, it is the noblest heritage of the Golden Age. It is the heritage that consummated a wonderful era of glory and religion, glory that led to darkness, but left behind it the brooding and mooning strength of this great and mysterious power, abiding forever, waiting and hoping, and this vast circumference of growing things, longing to go home, longing to be one with that power. Call it escape if you will, but to him it was the symbol of the natural, inevitable purpose of life, namely that man should seek understanding and love, and seek it only where it is, that is, in the universal consciousness of God.